can hear my neighbor crying. I can't breathe. Now I'm in the struggle and I can't leave. Calling out the violence of the racist police. And we ain't gonna stop till people are free. We ain't gonna stop till people are free.
Welcome to part two of episode five of the Ferguson Response Network podcast. I'm your host, at Leslie Mack. I was joined on this episode by my co-host, Ricky L. Hines II. And also we had two great guests, Becca, who you heard from in part one of this episode, and Leah Allen, who stayed with us for the full show. We broke this episode up because we ended up having a really amazing discussion about Selma, the movie, and also just some larger thoughts on the movement and the nuance that it involves moving forward from here. So this is going to be part two. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Ferguson Response. And you can also go to our website, FergusonResponse.org. And if you have events that you're planning, or if you want to see what's going on in your area in the movement, please be sure to visit FergusonResponse.tumblr.com. I did also want to make sure you're aware of how to reach our guests. You can find Ricky sometimes on Twitter at AUADOT.org. That's AUA.org with dot spelled out. And you can find Leah on Twitter at Leah V. Allen, and also at the CAPV, which stands for the Coalition Against Police Violence. Ricky is also the founder of the Americans United Again movement, and you can find them on their website, auamovement.org, or also on facebook.com/AUA movement. You can always find me at Leslie Mack. We're going to jump right into the discussion, starting with Selma, and then we head into MLK Day and start talking about some more nuanced details on the movement. And I do urge you to catch part one, where Becca gave some amazing information about being safe and healthy while you're out doing protests and actions. Ricky, what do you do on Monday? You going somewhere?
I'm thinking about it, but the answer is probably no. Simply because, one, I don't want to go by myself. That right. would be, that's especially after learning from Becca, that would be a right. terrible idea. Sherelle can't go just because of her back, so it not the best idea for me to go anywhere. But I do want to make sure that I keep an eye on what's going on so that I'm able to better report what's going on. For because sure. that's been a really – that's going to be really important, to be quite honest. And I'm sure we'll kind of cover that when we start discussing Selma. Because me and you talked about this in the pre-show. Mm-hmm. But it's – the one thing that we lost, or the biggest difference between then and now is – one, of course, we've learned a lot of lessons, but two, there was an objective and honest media mm-hmm. platform,
yep.
and it was a mass media platform, and there was no Fox News. Right. You had no place to just get your own facts like you have now.
Mm-hmm.
So this is going to have to be a long run. This is going to have to be something that takes a while.
Absolutely. Well, that's a good segue, as good a segue as any. To jump into Selma, Becca and Leah, have you guys seen the movie yet? Yes or no?
I haven't, and I'm gonna hop off and listen to the segment one when it's aired. I wake up really early for work.
You got it. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for being here.
It was a pleasure chatting with all of you.
Thanks, Becca.
Same here.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Have a good night.
Bye bye.
Take care.
So, Leah, you've seen Selma yet or no?
Okay, so no, please don't judge me. Don't throw any shade this way.
No shade. We don't. This is a shade-free zone here on the FRN podcast.
Of course. Not you guys. This is more so for the listeners, but I live in Atlanta. I was one of the four cities, right, where they did the early viewing, early showing.
Right.
And I have not seen it yet. I'm a huge and I hate to throw another movie in there, but I'm a huge Hunger Games fan movie, and I hadn't seen Mockingjay.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like the last movie that I saw. And it's been a while since I've been in the movies. And after seeing that, I don't even know if I'm ready yet for Selma.
Oh my God.
I will say that I've heard so many great things from friends that have seen the movie, but it seems like there is kind of, I don't know, what can you call it? Like Selma shock?
It is Selma shock. No, it's true.
Yeah, all the reactions.
I lost my shit. I lost my shit after I saw that movie for real. I lost it.
Yeah.
Drew is looking at me like, I don't know what to do with this angry black woman in my car, but she is freaking out.
Right. But I felt such an impact by Hunger Games, and then I'm like, oh God, am I ready for Selma? Because, and then knowing that, if I'm not mistaken, you guys tell me, but the story truly is Selma. Like, it ends in 1965. It doesn't go all the way to 68.
Nope. It's just Selma.
Yeah.
And funny that you mentioned Mockingjay, because I felt the same way in that movie. I kept hitting Drew. I'm like, man, this movie is about the movement. I know it. Like, it was so crazy. I felt exactly the same way. But this Selma shock is real. That's going to be the name of the title of this episode, I think.
Yeah, because I'm definitely dealing with it like right now. A word of advice to our listeners: actually go pay to see the movie. But if for whatever reason you can't pay to see the movie and you decide to find it elsewhere, don't watch it while sitting in traffic. That hurt. That did a number on me.
And for the record, Ricky is going to pay to see the movie. He just was being nice and watching it before the show tonight so we could discuss it a little bit.
Yeah, I'm actually going to see it Saturday with Sherelle. So
yeah.
I figured I'd just catch it a little early so that I'd be able to really be able to just do my due diligence and being able to talk
right.
about it.
Well, it's funny that you watched it alone this first time. I'll be interested to hear what your thoughts are watching it with other people, because my biggest and most visceral reaction actually was, I had obviously huge emotional reaction to the movie itself because it is powerful. And, you know, the links and connections and phrasings and everything that was depicted in the movie is so lamentably personally familiar with people that have been working in the movement. I mean, just so I can only imagine the people of Ferguson. Like, I don't know how they even went to see this movie. It must have been the most triggering thing to do. I mean, there's gas masks that the police put on. I mean, just everything about it was so evocative of every image and video that we saw come out of Ferguson after Mike Brown's death. And I just can't even imagine how visceral it must have been for all of them. But, you know, I'm sure 152 days in, they probably have some grounding techniques already under their belt to handle stuff like that. But just even for me, and I haven't even gone to that many actions, it was a little bit triggering just because I've heard some of those phrases said at me. And to think that it's still happening and all of those emotions, which happened as I'm watching the movie and I cried and all of that. But after the movie was what really set me off. We went to a theater that had a lot of older black people that went to it. It was a lot of like church group. One church group had like 50 people, and it, you know, so it was a lot of that. They were giving out posters beforehand. So it was, you know, a little bit of a community activity, I would say. And, you know, the movie ends, they do all the codas, this happened, that happened, and the last thing is signing into law the Voter Registration Act. And everybody starts clapping. They're all clapping, woo, whooping it up. And I just, it like took my breath away to hear them clapping, and I was like, we don't have that anymore. So what are you clapping for exactly? This win you think we actually had, it was taken away. Did you miss that? It just happened. So don't clap. We don't even get the satisfaction of clapping there. And I bet that wasn't the case when the movie was made. I don't know when they finished filming or when that part of the movie was wrapped. I don't know. But it was jarring to me. And a lot of people left like in high spirits, like, oh, we won, we marched, and they got to march, and da da da. And I was like, yeah, but see, that shit's still happening right now. So, did you not get that part? So it was hard for me because it was clear that a lot of the people there aren't doing stuff in the movement now or aren't as aware about it or somehow didn't make the connection. And it was really triggering when that happened because it was like, oh, Lord, now I got to convince these people, too, that something's going on. That was how that's the place it took me to. So.
Yeah, that movie, like I said, that movie did a number on me. It was interesting to see just how these same things can happen with just a generation or two.
Mm-hmm.
Over the course of a generation. Because, and when you look back at history, it's really no surprise, but it's kind of like, wow, I thought we were past this. You look at slavery. Right after slavery, they disenfranchised a lot of black people, but they were free. And then thereafter, they found ways to put them back in slavery by arresting them and putting them in jail for indeterminate amounts of time, denying them any rights, any of their constitutional rights, and railroading them mm-hmm. or hanging them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, then, you know, things get better with the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. And we have about 20, 25 years of black people progressively doing better, their progressive gains in income and in perceived freedom. And then we're reminded that this is going to be a constant fight. There's not a generation of us that's not going to have to fight, even mm-hmm. after we've realized exactly what we've wanted. Mm-hmm. 100%, we still have to fight to keep it.
It's sobering.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's sobering. It's infuriating. And it actually goes back to when Becca said, like, it's so infuriating to say Black Lives Matter because it's like, why do I have to say that? This is where we are, that I'm still having to say that. And
you know what?
The movie drives that home a bit.
Yeah. I thought about is that at no point when anyone, like when any of the trolls or anyone who has a problem with the phrase Black Lives Matter, the one response you never hear is, well, black lives already do matter. Think about that for a second. Mm-hmm. That's you never hear that.
Mm.
Ever.
Mm.
Ever. The entire meaning behind that slogan is, look, in reality, our lives matter. In practice, you guys aren't, this country isn't living up to that. And no one even argues that. No right. one even disputes it. Because they're perfectly fine admitting in a passive way that white supremacy exists mm-hmm. and it benefits them. They're living an okay life. They have someone, even on their worst day, at least I'm not black, to look down on.
Yep.
And for that subset of people, racism is all they have.
Yeah.
White supremacy is all they have. And they're perfectly fine with that. And we have to contend with not just them, but the people who benefit from them being so vehemently opposed to any kind of equality. And them just being silent about it. The mm-hmm. silent majority.
Yeah, the silent majority.
I have a question. I'm just curious because I've kind of been tossing this around in my head. I'm a huge Audre Lorde fan, and one of her quotes, one of my favorites, is she says, "Your silence will not protect you." Mm. And then she goes on really just to talk about anyone in any kind of instance of privilege, thinking that being quiet is actually going to help them. But my question is for you guys, do you think that is it better for some of those people just to be silent than to have people that say, to give their white silence, and which essentially I guess some people would say is white consent, versus the people that say all lives matter. Because Ricky, you bring up a great point, the fact that no one ever does say, well, yeah, your life already does matter. But in a sense, do they already say that and then some when they say all lives matter as a form of like oppressing black people from having any sort of voice, just saying, hey, you know, pipe down, know your role. You know what I mean? Don't think that you're more than what you should be. Don't think that you have a certain amount of power. You are still in this kind of place of just being inferior. So, but is it more damaging or is it, I guess I can't say is it better, but I guess is it more damaging, you know, when you have people that don't say anything versus people that do say something? I'm just curious.
I feel like it's almost a two sides of a coin almost in my mind, because one is very aggressive, obviously, when you're coming back with all lives matter. It's a deliberate aggressive move that you're trying to, you know, exhibit your strength and power in that moment. And it's really shitty and you're a dick if you do it. So there's that side of the coin. The silence part of the coin, though, is interesting to me because and this is something I don't think most white people ever have to do, which is we're left to consider what their intentions are because we don't know. And I have to assume if you say nothing that you agree with what's going on, because there's nothing, there's no other data for me to go off of because you're not saying anything. So to me, that's where the danger of that comes in. But I saw a sign at a protest the other day and it said, you can stay silent, but you cannot, you can no longer say you didn't know.
Mm.
And that's for me, that's where I come at with the silent part of it, is that you can stay silent, but you no longer get to feign ignorance. I'm done with that. We have been talking about this for 400 years. We've been talking about this specifically for months. It's everywhere. There's no corner of this country that has not been affected by this movement. And it's very obvious what's going on. You can either man up or woman up and understand and be a human being and recognize the struggle that's going on in front of you, or you can be an asshole. And I don't, to me, I don't have a lot of gray area anymore. I did, but I don't think that we have to deal with that gray area any longer, because the lines have been drawn too many times when police chiefs are asked to apologize for saying they want to make their workplace no longer have racism. When a police force defies their commanders and turns their back on them, too many lines have been drawn for you to feign ignorance. It just doesn't fly anymore.
But that goes to say, just think about how deeply racist we are as a country. That someone doing something so simple as trying to eliminate racism, which is in the public sector, trying to eliminate racism in the public sector, where it is illegal by law already, trying to enforce mm-hmm. that is unpopular.
Mm-hmm.
But we talk about the rule of law. What laws are we ruled by? There's an unwritten code, and you know that. It's not all that hard to see. It may not be written down anywhere, but it's not hard to recognize.
It's so true. I wanted to talk about Selma in the context of our movement, because I think that there are some interesting lessons and some parallels that we need to start looking at for the next phase of the movement, which is how we exert political power and affect real change in the world and get some real support for the movement. The movie, the brilliant thing in the movie to me, it is an emotional one, but to me it's almost a strategic one. You're looking at the inner workings and decisions and missteps and, you know, minimal decisions that get made on a hairpin that change the course of history. And it is a microcosm of that, but there is this idea that the work has to be thought out. And you have to really look at the tools you have before you and utilize them as effectively as you can. I really took, to me, that was the biggest lesson that I got from the movie was this idea of when you see, you know, SNCC and the LCLC, I always mess that up, SLCC, thank you, conflicting with each other. But then you see them utilizing all of those tools that I'm talking about. So they have to decide, you know, what is going to play better for the cameras? What's going to bring the media in? How can they use that media pressure to get the president to do what they want them to do? They have to pick the right city because when they went to a different one, they couldn't get the police chief to do anything that would be of note. And so all of those things I find to be really interesting. And we saw a lot of that in Ferguson, you know, deliberate actions where the goal was to get arrested because you needed to have something on record or you wanted to be able to have time in court or you wanted that to be shown. I do think the difference is that and this is why I can't imagine it just being so shocking to them is that the Bloody Sunday footage from the movie just so mirrors the night after Mike Brown was killed because they had no clue that the police even had tear gas, much less they were about to come in tanks and attack them. Like, why would you think that? I've never seen it ever before in my life. Had you guys ever seen that before? On an American street? Like, I was
not in my life.
I literally was sitting there. I dumbfounded. I can only imagine them sitting there like, this must be a fucking nightmare. This must be a dream. This can't be real. This can't be real life because it just didn't compute into what I knew as a normal occurrence to happen. And that scene in Selma really gets at the heart of that emotion of that, the surprise that you can't actually believe that they're going to do this. Like, all we're trying to do is walk across a bridge, literally.
I think my biggest takeaway from the movie was understanding that just what went wrong. Mm. Just where the cracks in the armor were and where the strong suits were and whether or not those things are still strong suits.
Yeah.
I mean, the media coverage is what helped the civil rights movement by and far. Without the type of media coverage, the objective, honest media coverage to a large audience, there would be no Civil Rights Act.
Nope.
Clearly, no one gave a shit about beating the fuck out of Negroes. That they didn't care to be filmed. It's only when that the rest of the country reacted to what happened that there was any pushback. And we have to be able to find those ways, and we have to be able to frame the conversation that we're having with regard to the end of white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
It's gotten to a point now where I don't think anyone within this movement is going to tolerate it anymore. I know that we've all said that it's going to be a long game, but also you need to fight like you want it done next week.
Yep.
Because if you resign yourself to it being a long game, you will not achieve it. It's going to take a sustained effort. And it's going to take a sustained sacrifice because at some point, in order to stop this cycle where black people just kind of maybe get by, maybe if they're lucky and if they're really, really fortunate, they live well, somebody's going to have to take an L at some point and say, you know what, I can resign myself to the violence and the poverty that it's going to take to climb out of this, because this needs to end. It's detrimental, not just to myself, but to my country.
Mm-hmm. And to our souls. I mean, really.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to our, just think, I'm really at a loss for words because it just shows how and reminds us, even to this day, how deeply racist we are as a country, that we even allowed any type of similarity between the two.
Mm.
We tolerated it as a country. I didn't personally tolerate it. No, it's not my it wasn't my particular cross to bear as far as tolerating it, but I'm still part of the group, and as a group we said that this was okay.
It's very true. I mean, apathy has come to bear witness on us, and this is why we find ourselves where we are today. And I do think that there's an internal shift that happens where, as you said, you just have to make a decision that I'm just not going to stand for white supremacy anymore. And when you have that internal shift occur, it kind of informs all of your actions moving forward. And I think that, and I know I've been reading so much and connecting with so many people have said, well, I lost so many friends, so many people that I used to talk to, so many people because they think, oh, that's all I want to talk about, or I'm too radical now, or whatever it might be. And
right.
it's I know it's been really hurtful to people, and it's been a really difficult time for them, losing these connections that they thought were so strong, losing friendships that they assumed were equal, and that, you know, the things that you cared about that person would care about as well, and finding out that that's not the case at all is difficult. But it also, I think there's a moment of resilience there, because even in the face of that, you still see people saying, well, oh well, I can't go back, so it kind of is what it is, and if you're not gonna like the way I am, then I guess you don't like me anymore. I don't know what to tell you. And I've seen so much of that. What about you, Leah? Have you experienced anything like that? Have you heard people talking about that phenomenon, if you will?
Oh, absolutely. I really expected it, because I can be outspoken about a lot of things. And when it comes to this one, I mean, this one just, it takes the cake. I'm not going to ever be silent again. And there's times where I kind of think back on my experience. I feel like I had truly been living, and I know I've said this a few times, but I was living in my own bubble of privilege. So feeling proud to be, you know, Black, and feeling proud of my history and things like Selma, and I mean, just really being proud and being okay letting people know that, but not really paying attention to things that were happening kind of right beneath my nose, and not wanting to dig into them, and wanting to be as Afrocentric as I could be without having to really do something mm-hmm. about it. If that were ever challenged, I'm very outspoken about it, but it really kind of, it makes me very introspective. And so I start to kind of reflect on myself and what those things are that I've been vocal about in the past, and was I going to speak up for me. As I've heard with a lot of colleagues, apparently the straw that broke the camel's back was Trayvon Martin.
Mm.
But the shot heard around the world that woke everybody up, that said, okay, just in case you got comfortable and you thought that, you know, after Trayvon Martin, it was like, it's okay, we're all, you know, we're all safe again. It was definitely Michael Brown. It was definitely Ferguson, a community that refused to be silent. Mm. And I've just come to the point where I said, I'm here to take up space. I'm going to say what I need to say. I'm not going to back down. And that's something that every person has to kind of answer for themselves individually, and how they do that, you know, is up to them. But for me, it just was like, I don't have a choice anymore. I expect people to not like what I have to say online, on social media, and I expect to have, even within my own family, as a Black woman, mm-hmm. I expect to have those moments of dissension where I'm having to tell my dad, like, please stop saying that if we stopped listening to rap music, and if black boys pulled their pants up, Ferguson wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. Because, and then I give them examples of, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. and all those others who did the right thing and were still killed anyways, and some of them hung, some of them shot. So it's one of those things where I think I came to a place where I said, I'm not going to turn back, and I'm not going to back down, and I'm not doing it to say, you know, I'm anti-police and I'm anti-white people, because there is a thin line. We have to not get so impassioned that we start bordering that line between love and hate. We do have to remember that love part of it, and that justice is absolutely love in action. But, you know, I did say that I just wasn't going to care who disagreed or who might kind of challenge me or decide I don't want to be associated with you, because just like you said, Leslie, that's all you talk about. It's like, no, that's not all I talk about, but this is something that's important to me. Mm-hmm. and I'm awake. I'm not going to fall back asleep.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I mean, to you said something, Leah, that kind of caught my ear. It really caught my ear with regard to respectability politics. And I, as someone whose mother had to remind them that they were black, actually to this day, my mom still has to remind me. And not because I don't know what skin color I am or skin tone, but I forget that I can't be myself. Mm-hmm. I have to be aware of how other people perceive me and act accordingly. And me personally, I'm not really one for thinking that's okay. Mm-hmm. And so I get into trouble for it. And I get this, the notion of respectability politics. It's a way of keeping one, it's a way of lessening the odds that it'll be you. But that doesn't justify the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you may have even if I played a 10% role, there's still another 90% that no one is addressing. And I'm supposed to handle the 10. What would the, you know?
And it also is so dangerous. I just find, I say this all the time. To me, it's the most dangerous thing that people combat the movement with is respectability politics, because, you know, your respectability will not save you in reality. And to give anybody the impression that that's the case is incredibly dangerous, because what it does is it sends them out in the world with a very false sense of security, because it doesn't exist. It just doesn't exist. And nothing is more dangerous than that. I mean, Becca was just talking about being prepared when you go to an action. We're talking about being prepared to go out in life in this situation. And when you're not prepared for the possibilities that could honestly come right to you, not that you come to it, but it comes to you, and you think for any minute that you could be treated differently than any other person, it's incredibly dangerous. And it drives me just up the wall when I hear anybody say it, because, you know, the wrong child or man or woman or person hears that and acts on that and thinks that it's true, and there'll be, you know.
Well, look at it this way. Look at the implications of what's said when you tell someone to pull up their pants or to act in a more respectable manner. You're telling them that them being themselves, for better or mm-hmm. for worse, them being mm-hmm. themselves will get them killed.
Yep.
Or get them hurt, or have them live in poverty only because of someone's perception of them.
Right.
And that perception usually is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the problem. We keep trying to tiptoe around what we can control. And yes, you can't control the system. And yes, you can control your own actions, but are those actions that you should have to control? What you can do is you can keep opening your mouth about it. You can keep pointing out how this isn't right. You have to set the expectation of being a human being before you set the expectation of being a black human being.
Yep.
set the stage. You could be president of the United States, and you're still not going to be treated as a full human being. Right. I mean, I'm just thinking, I don't have to look back to the 50s and 60s. I can look in 2015 at my president, a black man in the White House, and say, "What I've seen the most blatant racism and white supremacy I have ever seen against any public official." But this man is the president of the United States. So that's the challenge back to respectability politics. And I may get some slack for this. I'm a proud byproduct of a historically black college and university. And I have issue with the HBCU title in and of itself. But I just think about my experience and how, again, I talk about that being Afrocentric and being proud to be black. But I went to business school at an HBCU where I did come out thinking, okay, as long as I can adapt, because I live in a white man's world, as long as I can adapt and dress like them and talk like them and basically emulate to try to be them, then I'm going to be okay. Like, no one's going to necessarily judge me, and I won't face, you know, these biases that are just completely illogical. And I knew not to be that naive, but I was still thinking, you know, but what you said, Ricky, I wasn't necessarily told, and the language wasn't necessarily respectability to politics. It was just kind of like an attitude and an atmosphere that promoted that without even saying it. And that is very, like you said, Leslie, that's very, very dangerous. And so you're talking about politically, you know, what seems to be our lack of power. I'm like, how do we change some of those institutions? I mean, to me, an HBCU is a form of a political institution that could be, that could evolve and really be reformed to a different kind of mindset of thinking. And it's not to say be scared when you leave here and you know, fight the power and fight back and all that stuff and always wear your Afro. It's not necessarily about that, but it's just a matter of, you're still a human being.
Right. It's an attitudinal shift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
And it's, go ahead. That's actually a pretty good segue.
Yeah, I was going to just talk about that. The Washington
Portland
Post. Yeah, this piece is great, man.
I think it's interesting. I think he kind of ignores.
He ignores quite a bit, but the points that, some of the points that he makes really need to be heard, I think. We're going to read a little bit. This is from the Washington Post. It's Courtland Malloy. We'll have it on the show notes, of course. And he starts to discuss leveraging the presumed political unification towards racial attitudes that African Americans have. I'm going to use blacks because I don't like that phrase. Suppose, for instance, this is his words, we did more than believe that racial discrimination exists, but we actually use our political economic muscle to remedy race-specific problems. There are 42 million African Americans in this country with a combined purchasing power expected to hit $1.1 trillion this year. If Black America were an actual nation state instead of just a shaky state of mind, it would have a population slightly less than Spain's and rank as the 46th richest nation in the world, according to a statistical profile published by The Atlantic this year. And yet, African Americans spent much of 2014 on bended knee, pleading for justice, crying for jobs, begging for equal treatment, with President Obama declaring that, quote, a country's conscience has to be sometimes triggered, end quote, to bring awareness to the killings of black unarmed men and boys by police. Stand up, Black America. Leading up to the 2014 midterm elections, Barack Obama urged his base of support not to sit this one out. Too much was at stake. Black people needed to be as fired up as elderly white Republicans. Yet a poll by the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee leading up to the elections found that 67% of Obama's base didn't even know that an election was being held. No point in complaining about Republicans in Congress now. I'm going to stop right there because that's the point that's bullshit, FYI, because there's a lot of reasons why people didn't go to the polls. One of the reasons why President Obama did not urge his base of support not to sit this one out, because nobody allowed him to. They were too busy distancing themselves from him, which is ridiculous. You know, he just won the election 2 years before. But, you know, that's okay. Whatever. Mm-hmm. Just saying.
Well, I think that he ignores the fact that this is what's happened with Congress has nothing to do with black people.
No.
We don't control enough. We don't have enough. we don't even have enough votes to make this happen.
Nope.
Even if every eligible black voter went and voted, and we still and the rest of the voting population stayed the same, still wouldn't have the power to change much. This is an American problem. This is primarily a white American problem. And I mean white America as an institution. Me and Leah had this conversation on AUA interviews where we talked about the $1.1 trillion and how that's less than the share that we make up of the population.
Right.
Less. Mm-hmm. I think the spending. Consumer spending over like the past year was like $36 trillion, and we had like 1.1.
Mm-hmm.
You know that it sounds like it's a huge number, but mm-hmm. we all know that economically, black people are struggling.
Yes.
We were the mm-hmm. hardest hit by the housing
purposefully
crisis.
Struggling. Let's make that clear too. We were engineered to struggle the most.
Yes, and you're looking at a system in which now. Money reigns supreme in politics. So when you have a specific subset of people, again, even for those if you're listening and for some reason you don't see color, follow me on this.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a very specific percentage of the population that is disproportionately poor, and there have been specific policies over the past 100 years to ensure that happened. They were, as of the last financial crisis, they were specifically targeted for the worst of home loans and then were hit hardest by the housing bubble. And you have a pay-to-play political system. How much power do you think that those people would have to change their own destiny?
Right.
Martin Luther King put it in Selma, Oh gosh, how did he say it? I was on such a roll too. To take part in their own destiny, in their own self-determination.
Mm-hmm.
How much power does that really sound like? Even if you don't see color.
Not much.
No, and this is why we have to keep making noise because mm-hmm. That's all that we can do because we can't do this alone. We'd have to get money out of pot. Like, there are so many things that we would need to do to make it even conducive to rid ourselves of white supremacy
mm-hmm.
as a country.
Right.
Mm-hmm. First of which is getting money out of politics because of the implications.
Yep.
Whites are disproportionately rich. Blacks are disproportionately poor. People of color are disproportionately poor as a whole. And so when you have a system where, again, 80% of Congress are white males or are white Christians, and you know, in this instance, our president's black, and you know, the other 43 weren't. So, you know, it's no secret. It's really not. You have to really work hard to ignore it.
This is the part of the piece that I found the most interesting, and she speaks to your point. He goes on to say, an Associated Press survey 2 years ago found that 56% of Americans have explicit anti-black attitudes, and the rest don't love you all that much either. Harvard University professor Michael I. Norton found last year that many whites now believe anti-white racism is a bigger problem than anti-black bias, the latter having been all but eliminated, they say. On the most important issues, an NBC News Marist College poll found last month that 52% of whites have a great deal of confidence that police officers in their community treat blacks and whites the same, compared with only 12% of blacks. So whose conscience exactly are black people trying to prick? I actually had this conversation with Drew today. It's been causing quite a bit of strife between the two of us, to be perfectly honest. Because he does most of his work in the movement in talking to other white people, engaging with white people, enlightening white people, kind of moving them along the spectrum to understanding privilege and bias and racism and all of those things. And I've just gotten to a point where I just have been getting more and more unwilling to believe that that matters anymore. And I know what you're saying, Ricky, but I also feel like if we're waiting for the morality of white America to kick in, I don't know if that's going to happen. And I feel like we're going to have to figure out a different way if that's what the current model is.
Well, let's look at it this way. Throughout our entire history as a country, there are two types of instances that have occurred where black people have gotten a little more freedom, a little more liberty. Civil War, in which really was wasn't a majority of people who even were supportive of abolition,
right?
And we fought a war over it. Or somehow, like with the Civil Rights Act, the Civil Rights Movement, you appeal to people's conscience.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the only two ways. I don't think this country is going towards war anytime soon, and I don't see a president, while we have a system of pay-to-play politics, I don't see a president having the balls to say what needs to be said. Mm-hmm. Think about it. Our first black president is so afraid to speak about race because he knows that if he speaks about race expressly and is open and honest about racism, that it gives a very vocal minority the green light to say racist shit,
right,
all they want.
Mm-hmm.
And no one says anything. They just look at them like, oh, well, we didn't know this. Yes, you did. You knew exactly who that person was, and you've supported that person. You put that person in office. This person isn't like that. Yes, they are, Steve Scalise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is why this is a long game. It's because you have to build the foundation, because no matter what happens, if the majority of the country does not see you as a person,
mm-hmm,
then that society will always find a way to oppress you. It started with slavery. After slavery ended, it was mass incarceration and poverty.
Mm-hmm.
After that, and the lack of voting rights. Then they just switched it up to hyper poverty and mass incarceration again.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where there are as many black men, or there are as many black people in jail, which is the only time that you can have slavery in the United States is if you're, mm-hmm, as punishment for a crime.
Mm-hmm.
When people say slavery is abolished, it's a fucking lie. It's a very huge caveat. And so until they see you as people, as human beings, these things will continue to pop up.
But don't you think that my issue with that model is that in the interim, since the civil rights movement, our entire society has only gotten better at demonizing black people and black bodies. It has become, if it was a thread in the flag post of the flag before, it's ingrained in every single strand of the flag now. It is something that our society starts feeding the minute a person is born. And this confirmation bias continues throughout their lives. And I think that another big difference is that because segregation was so stark and black and white people didn't interact with each other, not that they do very much more now, but by design, it allowed white people to be enlightened about what a black person was like, because they truly didn't know. It was kind of this mysterious, unknown lifestyle that they didn't know about. And they don't, that doesn't exist anymore today.
To a degree, it does. I mean, you have to think about it. I'll put it this way. When I first went in the Navy, I don't know how many people I met that said, like, the white people that said they'd never seen a black person, really. And I went into the Navy in 2003.
Right.
segregation is just as bad as it has ever been, particularly with regard to housing. And so when you don't live in the same neighborhoods very often, you don't know them anyway. You don't know black people anyway.
Right, but you think you do. That's what I mean by the difference. The difference, I think, is that before the civil rights era, the segregation was a deliberate system. And so your ignorance was a true ignorance. You not only did you not interact with them, but you knew you didn't interact with them. And so you didn't feign as though you knew what was going on in the black neighborhood because you didn't know. And it was very obvious. But now this quote unquote post-racial America has brought forth this idea that white people know everything there is to know about black people. Even though the situation hasn't changed at all, and they don't know shit.
Well, that's always been the case in the northern states. That's always been the case.
Yeah, but segregation was the same in the north as it was in the south. We could do a whole show on that topic.
Yeah, but it was economically done,
right?
Which is the way it's being done now.
Yeah,
where it's not brute force, but you know when you purposely segregate or
you redline, yeah,
that's into legislation. What else can you say? And then have the gall to say that there's no such thing as white privilege,
right?
In 2015, mm-hmm. when mm-hmm. 65 years ago these behaviors were happening, there are people who are still alive.
Yep.
There are people mm-hmm. who actually bought homes and are still alive. You don't think if they didn't die off that easily, what makes you think their attitudes did?
Exactly.
What makes you mm-hmm. think that they didn't spread those attitudes?
So what do
we
you
are a deeply racist society?
Absolutely. And so is it practical to expect white America to wake up and is that something that black people are equipped to do? What do you think, Leah?
No, is the short answer that I'm going to give. and I'm just listening. I mean, on the segregation point, I think I would have to agree. I think that segregation is just as prevalent as it was back in during the civil rights era, except it is. It is segregation, so I'm going to call it what it is, but mm-hmm. it just looks like certain types of zoning for students that in their school district. It looks like gentrification. It looks like environmental discrimination. And, I live in this side of town, and I don't necessarily get a chance to go to this nice park, but other people do. I think it's absolutely very prevalent, and it's just not that clear-cut. As you said, Leslie, this, colored only.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that clear cut, but if we're paying attention, if we're conscious, then it is. It is very clear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more divisive and it's more damaging than ever before. But in terms of appealing to the conscience of white America, absolutely not. I don't see it happening because I'm just going to say this. This system that we work in, we're talking about, as you said, Ricky, we're 13.5% of the population of the United States as black people. We're talking about a majority, a white majority, that they helped to elect. Our president is part black, part white. They helped to elect this guy, but yet they don't, quote, see color, but they continue to demean him. And to a degree, Leslie, as you said before, to a degree, to demonize him,
mm-hmm.
to completely demonize him.
Absolutely.
So
they don't even say president when they say his name. This is unprecedented. But prior to President Barack Obama, anytime you saw the president of this country's name written or said anywhere, it always was President Bush, President Clinton.
That's it.
Never just a last name.
Obama.
It's ridiculous.
The only time they like the only time they like saying his name is when they can throw in Hussein. And that's a whole other birther issue, that crap right there. But that's when they like to say his whole name. But we're talking about a nation, a white majority. That's how they've treated a president that shares part of their culturally, ethnically, shares part of them. So there, I don't think there will be a possibility of appealing to their conscience. And then in turn, for even those who want to, like for those good folks, those good Christian white folk who actually had good intentions and wanted to abolish slavery, and for those folk now, even today, who are allies in the Black Lives Matter movement, even for them, they're still not going to be able to shift their the conscience and the mindset of those people around them until the entire system sees a complete disintegration of capitalism and white supremacy. I just don't think it is possible until that happens. Ari Lord said the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. Mm. So until even they won't even, so even if you get maybe half of white America to think as consciously as Black America does, and you get all of 13.5% of Black America to think that way, it still will not be possible to have that mindset of the majority completely shift and to be completely conscious until the entire system is changed. And because it's just systemic, like you said, Ricky, there's people that grew up with this, and culturally it's implied everywhere. They're teaching these beliefs to their children, whether they are doing it directly or indirectly, knowingly or unknowingly. Black people, those of us who are still enslaved in our minds, are teaching it to ourselves and to our children. But that's not necessarily a fault of ours, because that's the way the system was built. The system was built to keep that information and that power and that knowledge from us. So it is inevitable that we would replicate it and it would multiply. But I don't think it's possible to see that complete appeal. And then, honestly, I'm going to get a little aggressive here and just say, fuck trying to appeal to white conscience. Why do I need to appeal? I live in your world. I have to function day to day, not necessarily being a me in my own space, but I have to function as me in my own space, but knowing that this isn't truly my agency, because this isn't my world. I don't run it. I'm seen, and I live my life through a lens of the way that white America looks at me. So why should I even try to appeal to your conscience? I hate to be so brutal when I say that, but until they start to understand that it is a human problem, which I think is damn near impossible when you have a capitalist system, I don't see there being a real kind of shift in their mindset. And that's what makes this movement so much, so there's so much importance on it being sustainable. And like you said, Leslie, long range, we have to think long term and understand that we are going to struggle. We are going to have setbacks, but the more that we just continue to bring that attention, to make that noise, then we can continue to have the hope of just thinking strategically about how we're going to get there, knowing that it's just going to take a long ass time to get there.
Right. And I mean, I agree. I just think that you all, I think it's one of those things where it's not either or, it's both.
Yeah.
Because this is the thing, like I've said before, is that as long as white people continuously consider themselves better than us, mm-hmm. and as long as they remain the majority, if they wanted to wipe us the fuck out, they could. Let's just be honest. Mm-hmm. Remember the Native Americans? Remember the guys who had this land first? They're virtually, what are they, 4% of the population now, if that? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm being honest. This has to be a fight that we're willing to lose.
I mean, one could say that is slowly being done to Black people. It's just they're keeping enough of us around that are needed, which has always been the case.
That's it. Because it is to, again, to feed capitalism, of course. That's why I think maybe, Leslie, some of that you saw after Selma, people clapping and cheering the Voting Rights Act, and it's all good and we're all happy, and that energy and that fire dying is because look, they gave us something. Like, okay, we're going to give you some jobs now. We're going to give you the right to vote. We're going to let you, you know, go to our schools. And but then they start to, without really our real knowledge, they start to the quality of the schools disintegrates. There's still segregation there. I think that, Ricky, it's I don't.
That mindset still exists. That's why it's still there.
Yeah.
Like I said, I think that we need to continue making noise. But at some point, we have to understand that until that changes, we're going to continue to be fighting this fight.
Right.
No matter how long we gain equality, no matter what equality we gain, we're going to have to continue to have that fight until that happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Honestly, for me, the end goal would be for that to happen. Mm-hmm. That's honestly what – I don't want my kids to fight like this. I don't want my grandkids to have to fight this fight. I didn't want to fucking have to fight this fight. I would have much rather have just been me. Get to do Ricky shit.
Mm-hmm.
Have a podcast where I can just fuck around and talk shit all day. But it's not, you know, this is a fight for the future of my family. You know, for my own
life. But it's almost one of those, but Ricky, I don't think, I think our grandparents and great-grandparents, I think that they fought just for the same things that you're talking about so that you didn't have to, in 2015, still be protesting shit like this. At the same time, I even think that if they had that sort of, because that's why I get to Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream. And I think there's so many people, much respect to the family, the King family, but I think some of them, as well as just people from that era, that are still alive today, are in that mindset of kind of like this impossible fantasy. And that's not what Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream was about, but I think we're kind of stuck on that. So I would say that even for my grandparents to think that they were doing this because they didn't want me to have to fight for it is a little naive because of the fact that we're talking about over 400 years of a system. And I think we have to really break down, like, what is a system? You know, something that can basically operate and function on its own. And it doesn't really need anything. It's already been giving every piece of energy and fuel that it needs to run. And it does it without even thinking, without having to blink. It just happens. 400 years of this, mental, physical, emotional, spiritual, financial oppression. I even think that, I mean, I don't mean disrespect to them, but I think that even now, if we're thinking that we don't want our children to have to do this, we're talking at least 400 more years.
And I
Does
think,
that make
but
sense?
But I think that there's a notion there to hang something on, which is that we should not be preparing or even hoping that our children won't have to fight this fight. What we need to be doing is knowing that we have to prepare our children to fight this fight, and that is what did not happen. That is where the baton was obliterated by apathy and bullets, because that notion of, well, I want my kids to not have to fight for the things that I had to fight for. We need to get over that, because as Ricky said, we're just going to have to be continually fighting for these things. It just is what it is right now. It is. And
yeah, but I think there was this, and to add, I think there was this notion that we're past racism at this point. And I think that's where it became, you know, I don't want my kids to have to fight this fight.
Right.
So I'm going to end racism. And we get this illusion of ending racism with the, you know, obliteration of overt government enforced.
Of Jim Crow,
racism.
Basically.
Yeah. Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And everyone thought, okay, well, the system, you know, that part of the system is over. No, the system functions differently. And so it was just a misguided thought that that it was over, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
That
and
know,
it happened
things
again.
Were getting better. Things were getting better.
It
so
happened
we
again.
Let up. Yeah.
Right. And that's what I mean.
It
I think
again
that.
In 2008.
Right. And I feel like that's why we have to when we say part of this long play has to be preparing the next generation to continue this fight. It can't be us doing this in a vacuum and hoping we can get stuff done. It has to be, you know, part of that long-term play has to be changing the education in our schools. It has to be making sure that our children know that our history is not doesn't start with slavery. Like that is really critical, that idea of that, because we have to start building a different kind of country. And that's how you do it. We have to dispel these notions that slavery just happened. It didn't fucking just happen. It was engineered. And the wealth of this nation was built on the backs of Black people. And that is a fact. We need to be make sure that our children know that. And we need to make sure that white children know that. That they don't just come from the Renaissance and all of a sudden here they are in 2015 with iPhones. It doesn't fucking work like that. And that's where I feel like some of our energy needs to go. Now, the thing is that we have to be working in tandem, because we have some real world life or death issues that we have to address right now as well. You know, we cannot allow this police brutality issue to linger. And it can't be something that we put on the back burner until such a time as we can get everything done, because people are dying and it just can't wait. We have to, as part of the discussions that need to happen in all of these communities across the country and as a nation in general, we need to be talking about fighting on both of these fronts, some long range planning and some immediate moves, so that we know what the stakes are in the next election cycle, in our policy making that is going to be happening in all of our communities in the next 5 to 10 to 15 years. So those are really critical. And this is why I love this podcast. And I'm so glad you guys are here, because it's really great to at least get to talk about some of this stuff. And hopefully people can hear it and they can have conversations about it as well. And we can start to elevate what this movement is about, because it's not just about protesting. It's not just about one thing. It's bigger than one thing. And that's really why I wanted to provide a platform to talk about it, because it's much like Black people, not a monolith. And so I want to make sure that people are able to talk about it as nuanced as it is, because it's very nuanced and there's a lot of moving pieces that we are all going to need to be aware of as we move forward and try to find our way. And it's a very different level of awareness, I hope. To me, it's the strength that we have in the movement, is that I think that awareness is much higher now. And that's why when people call for leaders, like, we don't need any fucking leaders, because we're all leaders. We all have this knowledge. We all know the score. There's no additional information that only a certain few have and that we're waiting for them to bestow upon us. It's a different media age for that reason. But you guys reminded me actually a story about my grandmother. My family's from Jamaica. I was the first person in my family born here in the United States. And my mom emigrated here before my grandmother did. And my mom was here for a number of years. I think probably when I was about 5 or 6, my grandmother and grandfather decided they were going to emigrate as well. And so they got sponsored and they left Jamaica and they moved. They actually moved to Florida. And my grandmother didn't make it in this country for a year. She couldn't even stick it out a year. She went back home to Jamaica and she stayed there until she passed away. And I would talk to her all the time. I'd say, "Grandma, why did you not stay? You know, didn't you like it here? Didn't you like, you know, the food?" I was a kid, so I would ask her silly questions like that. Like, why didn't you like it here? And when I got a little older, she finally told me, she said, "Leslie, I just could not stomach leaving my country where I was a first class citizen to be treated as a second class citizen in another one." And she was definitely a very high society in Jamaica. She was a justice of the peace. She was politically connected. And so she had a unique life there. But it really struck me that for all of the schooling she had and everything that she had going for her, that she immediately was like, "Yeah, these people are treating me like I'm not shit and I'm not here for it." And it fuels me a little, because it's like, yeah, that's how I feel. I'm not going to stand for it anymore. I don't get to go to Jamaica or anything, but certainly, hopefully, we can all work together to instill that same fire and idea of not standing for being a second class citizen in our own countries any longer. Do you guys have any last thoughts? Ricky, do you have any last thoughts on Selma before we start talking about MLK Day?
Yeah, I think that it's shown me that we have to continue to test our country for racism, just to see how racist it is.
Yeah.
And the way that we test that is to bring it up. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, people are always like, oh, well, you're race baiting. Race baiting is tricking someone into saying something racist. Mm-hmm. I can't trick myself into being racist. No. I can't trick anyone else into being racist. You're either a racist and it came out, or you're not racist and you didn't say anything racist.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
There's only two outcomes.
Yeah.
So once we understand and we know, we can act accordingly. But we can't address a problem we don't fully understand.
And we can't pretend that it's not a problem anymore either.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That too.
That's huge. One thing I did want to mention is that Black-owned businesses across the country have come together to offer free tickets for students to go and see Selma. There are some restrictions in some different cities. You have to be part of certain after school programs, and some are restricted by specifically middle school. But if you want information on that, you can go to selmastudenttickets.com, and they have links there for all of the different cities. Philly just got added this week, so which is really great. I hope a lot of students get to go and see it, and that they're able to make a connection to the movement that's going on now. I actually urge everybody to go see the movie, although I'm so sick of seeing only movies where we are downtrodden and having to overcome every obstacle under the sun and then really don't even win in the end. But moving on to MLK Day, which is today is Martin Luther King's birthday, his actual birthday, the 15th that we're recording. And yep. So kicking a lot of action today and tomorrow, Saturday, Sunday, and of course on Monday, lots of stuff going on. I think by my last count that I had up, and I haven't even updated the website today, was close to 80 actions over the 3-day weekend, which is huge. And 46 of them on Monday alone that are taking place all over the country. So have you sensed a different feeling with MLK Day this year? What do you guys think? What's been the feeling of how people are looking at what they're going to do and how it's changed? I'm struck by what a difference a year makes. This holiday really has for me really just shown how the earth has almost shifted in such a short period of time with regard to normalcy, what we consider to be normal and what we won't stand for anymore. It's shocking.
Yeah. And like you said, what a difference a year makes. There's no way that you could have told me that this was going to happen this year.
Mm-mm.
No one was prepared for this. No, things like this, just at some point, the straw has to break the camel's back, and no one's really prepared for it. They know that it's going to happen at some point, but you never know when. And it's been an incredible year. It's been tiring. It's been a lot, but it's good to come back around and see that there's so much progress being made with respect to the attitude and our attempt to reclaim him.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we even thought to do that.
Which is just the acknowledgement that it had been stolen from us, really. That's the part that I think is great about the Reclaim MLK. The theme, the idea of it is just that the acknowledgement that, you know, this shit we've been fed is crap. It's not truth. It's what was convenient to pacify and to make white America feel good. And we're like, yeah, that doesn't really match up with what happened. Because otherwise, why'd you kill him?
Right.
It just doesn't even make sense.
Well, I absolutely agree that it's amazing that we've gotten to the point of reclaiming him and reclaiming what that infamous speech was all about, which wasn't really the I Have a Dream speech, but let folks kind of do some research. I'm sure there's some resources on the website where people can actually read that speech and understand what it was truly about. But I will have to say that I think it's going to take more than a day and a weekend and a year, really, for all of Black America to come to a point of consciousness about reclaiming MLK. And knowing that it's more than just a man, but I mean, he is an icon. So it makes sense that we kind of center it around that and his strategic thinking, his mindset, his philosophy. But I, like I said, I don't think it's going to happen in a weekend or this year or next year. I think it's going to take a constant, consistent effort to challenge how we perceive Martin Luther King Jr., the civil rights movement, and so many other things of that era, and reclaim them every single day. I see a lot of things here. I've gotten the opportunity to be at a few of the events that the King Center has hosted, which have been wonderful panels and town hall forums and great dialogues happening. But when I see that, obviously, their business, they have money to kind of make off, and they have a foundation to run as well. So let me not add that they do have nonprofit side. But when I see that kind of in the background, the dream and Martin Luther King Jr., as certain folk want us to remember him as that being the prominent message, I kind of tense up a little bit. And I say, okay, well, yeah. And it's not just that it's necessarily older people, but it's mostly people who are either just not conscious or have an attitude of respectability, an air of respectability. So while it's absolutely great for us, and I think it speaks a lot to the minds of this movement being energized, being focused, and being conscious enough to say we have to reclaim him for ourselves, there's still a side that is just not quite there yet. And so it's going to take some effort on everybody's part.
Yeah, and I think part of the reclaim notion, too, it's not just reclaiming MLK, but I liken it to this idea that we've been kind of sold this bill of goods that the civil rights movement ended, right? And so for me, part of the reclaiming is this idea that, no, the civil rights movement is alive and well, and it has to be. It's a necessity for us to live, because otherwise we're left with nothing to, as Ricky put it, test the country and see where we are and know that adjustments have to be made, because we have to be concerned about ourselves and how we're being treated. And that's what the civil rights movement was. It was a conscious, collective concern for the well-being of Black people. And so we need to get back to where that is the norm 24/7, that we're all in the mindset that we have to be consciously aware and knowing how we're being treated and what we need to do to affect that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Definitely.
So we have, as I said, so many cities having events that are coming up this weekend, starting on Friday. I've already started posting stuff on Twitter from the website, but you can go to fergusonresponse.tumblr.com. You can search by date if you're looking for a specific date. You can also search by location, by state. And you can also search by every event that's happening in conjunction with MLK Day weekend. So there's lots of ways for you to take a look at what's going on where you are. And it's been amazing to see so many different things going on. I know in Albuquerque, they're doing a funeral procession with names of people that have been killed. They're doing lots of parades, obviously, but some different ones. I know in Indianapolis, they're doing a march around the obelisk that's there in the center of the city. What's the plan for Atlanta, Leah?
Oh, man, Atlanta, get ready. So we are basically shutting the city down as it is necessary for MLK weekend. Mm. Tomorrow we're actually doing a, won't necessarily call it a protest, but it's really an interruption, so to speak. And I think that's what a lot of great actions of this movement, some of the really, at least favorable ones in my mind, the ones that really stick out are the ones that make people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And so we'll be out at Phillips Arena, which is our main arena here in Atlanta, and kicking things off tomorrow night. And then on Saturday, got an exciting day planned with our lovely
CNN
Center headquarters. So I hope they're ready for us. I hope they pay attention. But we'll see what happens on Saturday. But Monday, absolutely a big day. We're actually holding a community rally before the MLK Day parade. And that rally is going to be at noon at Underground Atlanta. So everything is centralized around downtown. So that's why I say we're shutting it down. And all of that information as well is on the Ferguson Response Tumblr. So
yep, all
I'm ready.
Yeah. Awesome. Here in Philly, we had an action today. It was kind of an impromptu action because Eric Holder showed up in town to discuss, I guess, policing in city with our horrible police chief Ramsey and Mayor Nutter. And I'll have to talk about that another time. I'm still processing the event today. But tomorrow there is a Hands Up Fight Back rally at 30th Street Station. It's going to be massive. So if anybody's listening, you're from Philadelphia, hit that up. 5 p.m. 30th Street Station, Hands Up Fight Back rally. And on Sunday night, we have an awesome event at the Rotunda. It's a MLK citywide celebration on Martin Luther King Day Eve. It's organized by an amazing group of young people. There's going to be like a DJ there, and all different organizations are going to be there collecting signatures. And you can join different lists and get information about all the different organizations that have been coming together to do this important work. And then on Monday, we have our big march. We are expecting somewhere in the neighborhood of 10,000 souls to be in attendance. And we're going to be marching from our education building, which is 440 North Broad Street, around City Hall, and we'll be ending up on 6th and Market, which here in Philly is at Independence Mall, and that is where our final rally is going to take place. So that starts at 1:30 on Monday. It's going to be cool. It's also up on FergusonResponse.tumblr.com. I'm actually speaking at the end rally on Independence Mall, so if you come, you'll see me there. I'm a little nervous.
Yeah, this is kind of historic, right, Leslie? I mean, something like this hasn't been done in Philly in a long time.
Yeah, it's been, I think our last count was like 35 years since they've done a march like this in the city.
Sheesh.
So it's pretty huge. Yeah, here in Philly, it's this big like day of service thing for MLK Day. And so they have this entire program set up where all of the schools and parks register and people go and like paint schools, clean up sidewalks, and basically do people's jobs. I say that because I think workers deserve a living wage, and so they should be able to do their jobs, not because I think it's demeaning work. But it certainly is not in the spirit of MLK at all to not respect the work that's being done by the working class. He was very big on that. And so we've been working really hard to kind of switch this attitude from a day of service to service in action, which means that you're going to get out there and march with us. And we have 6 demands that are going to be kind of the focus, headed under education, jobs, and justice. And I'm expecting it to be a really amazing event. And I'm still putting the finishing touches on my speech, so it should be interesting. I'm getting to talk about the movement, so I'm not talking about local stuff, so it should be interesting. And I'm pretty early on the dais, so I can get it over and done with. I wanted to shout out, as far as our organizational spotlight, the Coalition Against Police Violence, CAPV, of which Leah is a founding member. CAPV is an organization devoted to demilitarizing the police departments and ending police abuse through community policing policies and economic empowerment. We view ourselves, they say, as liaisons between law enforcement and our local communities, and their motto is, we believe that the best in each of us protects all of us. You can find them at thecapv.org, and they're also on Twitter. I think it's at CAPV, or is that at thecapv? Leah, do you know?
It's, yeah, Twitter is thecapv, and then facebook.com/thecapv.
Excellent. And you can find all of the almost 30 marches that CAPV has spearheaded putting together. They were the start of this coalition to get all of these cities involved in hosting marches or some sort of action on MLK Day at 4milemarch.org. Of course, all of this stuff will be in the show notes this week. Final thoughts from you guys. Ricky?
I know this one has run a little long.
It did run long.
But I must say I enjoyed the conversation. I think that it was great to get a lot of the ideas that are floating around out there out mm-hmm. and have an open discussion about them. I'm always about open discussion. So I'm glad this ran a little long to be able to cover that, especially, you know, everybody got an extra day off, so
y'all can listen to it.
Or at least if you have a, if you're a government employee, you definitely have it off.
Right.
But yeah, so you got some extra time to listen.
Exactly. How about you, Leah?
No, I thought it was excellent. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciated Becca being on as well.
Yeah.
And like Ricky said, everybody need to take the time and kind of listen and use this as a great launching pad for having their own conversations, because this is how movement work really keeps going, is we're just willing to talk about this and start thinking about and strategizing solutions. So I'm just really blessed and happy to be a part of it. So thank you guys so much for having me on. You guys are the best co-host in the world.
Hey, don't tell Sherelle or Drew that. So just
hey, shout out to AUA.
Shout out indeed. Yeah, so I want to make sure we get that going too. So you can find Ricky on Twitter sometimes at AUADOT.org, AUA.org. And you can also get more information about the Americans United Again movement on their website, AUAMovement.org, or Facebook.com/AUAMovement. And you can get in touch with Leah, as we said, at the CAPV on Twitter, or at Leah V. Allen. Did I say that right? LeeAvallen, right?
You did. I gave him my whole government. The fans
awesome.
Always watching.
The full stuff. One. The full one. Awesome. and yeah, and I will get so that information from Becca. And thank Becca so much for coming on. It's huge. I think I'm going to have her back again and do another segment on this health aspect of doing this work, because that was some mind-blowing stuff, man. I'm about to re-listen to it even.
Absolutely.
Yeah, really huge.
She saved my life. She told me that I saved my own life.
Yeah, it's true. It's the truth. And also, you know, too, Ricky, I think you might be equipped to, maybe not right away, but, you know, could start thinking about making a way for you to go to an event or two, maybe.
That was extremely helpful.
Yeah, it's huge. And I hadn't thought of it either. I mean, I've been going to this thing just kind of throwing myself out there. I'm like, yeah, maybe I should ground myself. Maybe I should be giving a little forethought to this. Two quick announcements. Next week, I'm going to be launching, along with Davey Celeste, a new Ferguson Response Network podcast series called MLK Unfiltered. And we are going to be running that through Black History Month. That's going to be really cool. We're going to be delving awesome. into really deep into what MLK's legacy is, what he stood for, connecting it to what's going on today. There's going to be some stuff for younger people, like middle school age. We're going to have at least one podcast devoted to talking to them about MLK. And so I'm really excited about that. And then also in February, we'll be launching the Ferguson Response Local podcast, where we're going to be spotlighting a different city or local area, and just talking, kind of having a panel discussion with people representing different areas of the country, so we can get a feel for what's going on all over the country and kind of how the movement is progressing in different areas of the country. I think it's going to be really neat to listen to those conversations. Again, you can find the Ferguson Response Network podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Just search for Ferguson Response Network. And you can also find us on our website, FergusonResponse.org. And of course, if you're looking to have an action or would like to look for an action to attend, you can go to FergusonResponse.tumblr.com. I am actually, Ricky, going to play the same song I played last week because I just, honest to goodness, loved it so freaking much.
Yeah, it was damn good.
So we're going to just listen to it again because I loved it.
No complaints here.
That's right. This version of the song was adapted and additional lyrics added by Jessica Anderson, who's also the singer, and she's accompanied by Tyler Brooks. And I definitely just call it not even the same as the other versions of this song, because she, Tyler and Jessica, really take it to another level.
I can hear my people crying. I can't breathe. And now I'm in a struggle and I can't leave. We're calling. And we ain't gonna stop till people are free. Oh, we ain't gonna stop till people are free. Sending out a call to all of those who lead to use your power now to help others see that all
Thanks, and have a good night.